3 p.m. So I have ID to prove that now. We are in the temporary Anchorage LIO in the conference room on the first floor. With me this afternoon, Senator Click Bishop, Senator Kathy Giesel, Representative Josephson, and Representative Guerra is out of the room for the moment, but he's also here. Online, we have Senator Dunleavy.
Yes.
Is there any other elected officials online that wish to identify themselves? Seeing and hearing none, today the LBNA committee is facilitating a hearing on the recent preliminary determination by the Department of Natural Resources regarding the royalty rate modification application by Kalis Energy. We will hear an overview of the project and the application from Kalis Energy, followed by an overview of the process by the Department of Natural Resources. Are there any questions from LBNA committee members? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to welcome Pat Foley, Senior Vice President of Kalis Energy, to the table. I believe each of you have a presentation on the table and available in the back. And the presentation is also available online for anyone listening. Welcome, Mr. Foley. If you have a team that you'd like to introduce, please do that also.
Very good, thank you. Shall I begin?
Please.
Madam Chairman, thank you for inviting Kalis today to visit with you and help bring you up to speed on the application that Kalis had filed for a modification of royalty within the Aguric unit on the Torok interval on a development project that we call Nuna. So for the record, my name is Pat Foley. I'm the Senior Vice President for Kalis Energy Alaska. A little bit of personal background on me. I came to the state in 1983. I worked 20 years for ARCO, mostly here in Alaska. I worked about 2 years for BP. I had the pleasure of working for Pioneer for about 10 years, helped them start their business here, incubate that business, and at the end of the time with Pioneer, I was the president of the Alaska organization. What I'd like to do today is first introduce on the phone with me is Matt Musselman. Matt is the technical expert. He's also a vice president with Kalis. He runs our business development group, and he has been intimately involved in the royalty modification application. So you may have some specific questions for me, and you may also have some specific questions that are better answered by Matt. So my plan is I was going to go through a little bit of a background on Kalis, so you're familiar with who we are, also describe the Nuna project, describe our application, the procedure, the process we went through, and help share some of the facts as to why we believe the Nuna project was deserving of a royalty modification. And then I believe Department of Natural Resources will follow up and actually present to you the work that they did, the evaluation they conducted, and how they came to the determination that they arrived at.
Mr. Foley, could you pause for just a moment? Senator Dunleavy, are you able to hear all right?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Please continue, Mr. Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. So a brief history on Kalis. First, the name. Kalis is the Roman god of the sky, and it's a privately held exploration and production company. It was established in 2011 by Jim Musselman. And Jim had two previous very successful exploration and production companies. They are Triton and Cosmos. Without going into any great detail, these are companies that did business in Gulf of Mexico and also offshore West Africa, made very significant exploration discoveries, developed those fields, and later sold those business enterprises. Kalis purchased all of the Alaska assets in April of 2014. Along with that purchase came all of the great people that had worked for Pioneer for the last decade. So specifically, we have about 80 Alaska resident employees here in the state, both in town and on our North Slope operation, which is the Aguric field. We will seasonally employ contract workers this coming winter will be exceptionally large in our workforce. We'll have over 500 employees. In a typical year, we have about 200 to 300 contract workers. This year, because of a seismic 3D program that we're shooting, one at our Agurik field and one on some brand new leases we purchased over by Badami, and in addition to our construction on the Nuna project, we will have as many as 500 contract workers employed by us this year in the state of Alaska. Historically, so the purchase that Kalis made of Pioneer was a stock purchase. They actually acquired the entire entity. So when I speak about some numbers, I'm going to talk about the legacy expenditures that Pioneer made. So Pioneer in the state of Alaska has spent $2 billion in capital and expenses. And we have made payments to the state of Alaska in the form of royalty and ad valorem taxes of about $100 million. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the funding of Kalis. Kalis is unique in that we have a very, very large private equity funder. It's Apollo Global Management, and Apollo has pledged to us $1 billion in capital to help us develop the Agurik assets, which include Nuna, as well as some other exploration opportunities. We currently have a $300 million second lien loan, and we have additional credit facility available to us should we need more. So now I'm going to talk about our budget for 2015. And the Agurik unit, we have a little more than a $500 million capital budget. It is split basically 50-50 between our ODS development project and Nuna, the new project that we're speaking to you today about. And one thing that you'll find about Kalis is we are going to be careful stewards of the environment and the resource, but at the same time, pace is everything, and we're going to go as fast as we can in a responsible manner. Kind of towards that end, the development project that Pioneer did in the North Slope, Agurik, from first lease to first oil was 6 years. That's been unprecedented. What you're going to find with Kalis from the acquisition in April until first oil is going to be a little more than 2 years for that project. In addition, we're going to shoot we're a technically oriented company. We have two high-resolution 3Ds, one that we're going to shoot over the Agurik field and one that we'll shoot over a series of brand-new leases that we hope to be awarded soon.
Senator Gaetzel has a question.
Yeah, I did just have a question on that last slide. The third to the last bullet point should say the fastest pace ever in Alaska. Am I correct?
Senator Gaetzel, through the chair, yes, ma'am,
okay.
That is correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
I have one quick. Do you want us to hold questions to the end? Or?
As long as we're moving, I'm okay to ask questions if it's all right with Mr. Foley.
Mm-hmm. This is just a quick one. Pioneer had an excellent relationship with the Alaska Native community on the North Slope. Did that transfer over with the Kalis purchase?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, yes, I believe it does. And I have to emphasize the fact that, you know, the same great people that you had the pleasure of working with at Pioneer are the same great people that we have at Kalis. So all of the relationships that were established by Pioneer are continued by Kalis.
Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Representative Faircloth, for letting me attend. I do have a question. Pioneer started working on this in 2010, roughly, with exploration and development wells, when ACES was the law, and then your company purchased the lease in November of 2013 when a statement was made that you expected to begin work pretty much immediately, and that was all without royalty relief. So at some point, I'd like to know why you need royalty relief for a field that you purchased saying you were going to begin work pretty much immediately on.
So Representative Guerra, through the chair, a bunch of questions there. So Pioneer actually began its business in the state in 2002. The Nuna project, you're correct, it's about the 2010 time frame. And with no disrespect to my previous company at all, Pioneer had lost a little bit of enthusiasm in Alaska. They were blessed by tremendous success in the lower 48 and Permian Basin, and they were focusing 100% of their capital on developing those assets. And because they were not in a position to continue to fund Alaska projects, instead, they sold the asset to Kalis. And so this transaction with Kalis started, sometime in the summer of 2013. We actually closed on April 15th of 2014. And as early as December and January, Kalis had started with preliminary conversations with the state of Alaska about if we buy this asset and if we develop Nuna, what can we do to improve the economic terms?
Thank you, Mr. Foley. Representative Garrett, if we could continue a little further, I think that there's more to be had for your questions and maybe a larger response to dig deeper. Did you have a follow-up now?
I guess it's probably a yes or no question, but nobody had promised you royalty relief when you purchased this field, right?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, the answer is no. No one was in a position to make that kind of a promise, and no such promise was ever made.
Senator Faircloth? Senator McKinnon?
Senator Dunleavy.
Very brief follow-up on this. Was the $1 billion, it's related, but was the $1 billion commitment regarding Apollo contingent upon a royalty discussion or modification?
Senator, through the chair, the financial commitment that Apollo has made is to the business enterprise. Specifically, for the Nuna project, we require a sanctioning decision, and we have obtained from Apollo what I would consider a contingent sanction approval, meaning they will fund the project subject to the finalization of royalty modification.
Senator, so anything else?
That's a yes, then, is what I'm interpreting that to mean. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Foley, can you share with the committee information that you had on, at least at your acquisition time, on the status of what you knew about the find itself?
Madam Chairman, if I may, it might, as I proceed through my presentation, maybe that answer will become more clear. And if not, ask again, and I'll try and answer it as best I can. Thank you. So now I'm, for the benefit of the people on the phone, I am on the third slide. And so the point of this slide really is to try and demonstrate that I believe Kalis is the type of company that the state of Alaska would like to have continuing to do business here, and we'd like to see many, many more companies exactly like Kalis here in the state. So the state of Alaska had an oil and gas lease sale, I think it was about 2 weeks ago. Kalis was the apparent high bidder on 323,000 acres of leasehold. And what shows on this map in yellow are the leases which we appear to be the apparent high bidder. So the lease tracts aren't yet awarded, but Kalis has submitted the high bids, and the odds are high that all of these leases will be issued. So it represents 126 tracts, and the total lease bonus that will be paid by Kalis for these blocks is $15 million. And I had spoke previously about the pace of activity. Kalis had actually made a commitment to one of the 3D geophysical companies to acquire brand-new high-resolution 3D seismic over this block of leases, and we'd started those commitments before the lease sale ever happened, before we knew we were the high bidder, so we kind of stuck our neck out on that. So this winter, we will have a 3D seismic program shot over in this area. Again, for the benefit of the people on the phone, I'm now on the fourth slide, and this is just some facts and information about the Agouric unit and the Nuna project specifically. And I'm going to focus your attention first on the map on the right. So the black outline is the area that are the leases that are owned by Kalis within the Agouric unit. And the Agouric unit has two different developments, so to speak. One is the existing offshore island, which is the small black box out in the mouth of the Harrison Bay out in the Colville Delta. And then the new project that we're here to speak to you today about is the NUNA project. And phase one of the NUNA project is shown by the area outlined in brown, and there are two drill sites that ultimately may be associated with the NUNA project. So back on ODS, so the ODS makes production from the Nuiqsut, the Kuparuk, and also the Torok, and total estimated recoverable reserves from that ODS island is roughly 100 million barrels. My working interest partner at Agoric is Eni with a 30% interest. Kalis has the remaining 70%. Now for NUNA, Eni has gone non-consent, and so all of the working interest and all of the monies are spent exclusively by Kalis. So at ODS, we currently enjoy about 13,000 barrels a day of gross production. We have a capital budget in 2015 of about $250 million. I have an island out there that has 48 well slots. 36 of those slots have been used. So that leaves me with 12 unfilled slots. So there are at least 12 more wells to be drilled. There's additional work where we can work over wells. And we have a possible project to expand that island to put a few more acres of gravel and to add an additional well bay, which would allow for the drilling of 12 more wells. So 12 plus 12, 24 new wells potentially be drilled from ODS. I'm going to shift all the attention now to NUNA. So NUNA is the project that is also within the Agoric unit. It is today exclusively focused on the Torok interval, and phase one has a single drill site. It's shown on this map as NDS1. There's also a road system that will be put in place that connects back to Kuparuk River Unit Palm 3S drill site, and we have flow lines that connect back to OTP, the Agoric tie-in pad. One thing you may recall is Kalis has no processing at all in our unit. So we've made contractual arrangements with KRU, the Kuparuk River owners, to process on behalf. So I believe we are the sole true third-party facility sharing arrangement anywhere on the slope. And that same arrangement will continue for the NUNA project. So NUNA, we started the project by drilling three wells from the ODS island. So there's two producers, one injector, and that was a little bit of a pilot. We had to convince ourselves that we could flood this reservoir, that we'd have a successful water flood, and we have demonstrated that. We came back and we've also drilled two appraisal wells, the NUNA 1, NDS 1, and the NDS 2. Those wells both were drilled. The first well was drilled in 2012, and in 2013 we came back and drilled a second well, and both those wells were fracture stimulated. They were production tested, and they flowed something in the ballpark of about 2,500 barrels of oil a day. So we do have an estimate of recoverable reserves for the NUNA resource, and it is somewhere in the range of 50 to 100 million barrels. And again, phase one is 30 development wells. So next I'm on slide five, and this is just a picture of a roadside geology. So this is something you'd see as you drive down the road. And what this demonstrates is a laminated reservoir. So, and the reservoir that we're going to develop in Torok, in the NUNA project, is very similar to this. And what this picture shows, this is just a 5-foot section, but it shows the sand are the big blocky areas that stick out that haven't weathered, and then the shales are the tiny little layers in between. And so if you kind of keep that image in mind, and if I go to slide six, this is a core photo from the Kalubik number 2 well. This is a well that ARCO drilled in 1998. And so this is a core library. So this is a picture of the rocks that came out of the ground, and they're shown under fluorescent lights to try and make the oil-bearing sands show in a different color. So without going into too much detail, the oil sections are those that look like yellow on this photograph, and all the black are the sections of shale. And so this core library is 3 feet thick, so each one of these sticks is 3 feet long, and if you took all of these and laid them end to end to end, this represents a section of about 80 feet. And this is the exact reservoir that we're trying to produce. So the challenge here, unlike the Kuparik or unlike the Ivashak in Prudhoe Bay, which is a giant, you know, enormous, thick, nice, clean sand, we have these laminated layers of a little bit of sand, a little bit of shale, a little bit of sand, a little bit of shale, and this goes on for as much as 250 feet. And because of this, this reservoir has very low permeability, low porosity, and the only way to get the oil out of the ground is by fracture stimulation treatments. So we'll come in here and we'll fracture both the producer wells as well as the injection wells. And that's a technique that no other reservoir on the North Slope has had to employ. Because we have these very thin laminated layers, it's not uncommon to have to fracture treatment the producer wells. But then when we lay a horizontal well to inject into, we have to break those rocks open so the pathway that the injection well water follows is the same as what, you know, they need to do to get to the production well. So now I'm on slide 7, and now I'm going to talk specifically about the application process and the preliminary determination that was issued by the Division of Oil and Gas. So again, the conversation began as early as January 2014, but you'll recall that Kalis didn't close on the transaction until April 15th, and then there were a series of assignments that had to be approved, so it was not until July 1st of 2014 that Kalis actually had standing to submit a final, formal, and complete application. And then in October of 2014, the Division of Oil and Gas issued your preliminary finding and determination, and we are now in a period of a public comment period under that determination. So next I'm going to talk about exactly what was preliminarily approved by the Department of Natural Resources. So what we've asked for is a modification of royalty down to 5%. 5% is the statutory floor that the state can grant, and the determination that the Division of Oil and Gas has issued has those base royalties maintained at 5% until a gross revenue target of $1.25 billion is received. In that finding, the state has come to the conclusion that it is in the state's best interest, and as I continue, I'm going to explain why I believe there are many benefits to the state and why foregoing a little bit of royalty up front is justified because of the significant jobs that are created and the additional revenue that will flow to the state later on in project life. So one of the other criteria that the state has when they consider any modification is kind of a simple concept of, hey, if we're going to help you on the front end, convince us how we can share on the upside. And the answer to that is I have a unique collection of leases where 75% of the leases in the Nuna development are burdened not just by royalty, but also by a net profit share interest to the state of Alaska. So those leases are burdened by a 1/8 royalty plus a 30% net profit share. So in the simplest form, when this project goes forward and when it reaches economic payout, over and above all of the other typical fiscal benefits the state enjoys, they also have a 30% net profit share interest in about 75% of the Nuna resource. Also, in the state's preliminary determination, they have come to the conclusion that, well, let me take one step back. Absent royalty modification, there's no doubt that this project will be delayed. It may still happen, but it will be delayed a year or two or three, or it's a little bit unknown. As you know, we look at the oil price this morning, and we're all a little bit concerned about where it is, and more importantly, where it's going to be years down the road.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Just to understand, when the state bids out a lease, was this 12.5% royalty plus the 30% net profit interest that was part of the lease bid?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, sir. It was part of the lease terms.
I don't have a follow-up. I just want to make sure that was clear.
So, Madam Chairman, so the point that I was trying to make was, absent royalty modification, the project will be delayed, and one of the conclusions that the state came to in its preliminary finding was that the cost of the delay, so on a present worth time value basis, the cost of a delay of several years exceeds the loss or the diminishment in revenue that the state foregoes because of the royalty modification.
Madam Chair?
Senator Dunleavy.
The question, I just want to be clear, just to clarify. So when the lease came out and these issues were known, you still bid upon the lease. Just curious what the thinking was behind that. And now you're coming before the state asking for modification. Just trying to understand it.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair. So this lease, the leases that are burdened by 1/8 and 30% net profit, were actually originally issued, and I'm not going to have the story perfectly right, but they were issued to a group of companies back in the early 80s, I believe, and they were developed, or they tried to be developed, by ConocoPhillips and other parties. They actually drilled all the same rocks that we see that we're developing in Agouric, and they determined those leases were uneconomic and not worthy of their investment. So they made a deal with Pioneer back in 2004, I believe, where they assigned all of these leases to Pioneer, and it's Pioneer that took them subject to the existing lease terms.
Senator Dunleavy, follow-up?
I guess the only response I'd say is, okay, so it was understood that these were the conditions of the lease, correct?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, yes, we understood what the lease terms were when Pioneer made the acquisition and when Pioneer developed Agouric. You may recall that Pioneer also submitted and was granted application for royalty modification on the Toroq and the Kaparik and the New Exit, not the Toroq, the Kaparik and the New Exit formation within the main Agouric unit.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Guerra, did you have a follow-up? Thank you.
Madam Chairman. So I also want to kind of bring to your attention the state and the way they have crafted their decision. They kind of hold Kalis to the fire, their feet to the fire, as far as development obligation. The deal is that they could agree to a royalty modification, but along with that needed to come a commitment of diligent development. So some of the terms that are included in that is that there must be a firm final sanctioning decision by the end of this year, by 12/31/2014. And then there's also a spend calendar requirement that says that we have to begin our capital investment for facility building by March 31st of 2017, and we have to have sustained commercial production from Nuna by March of 2017. So now I'm on slide 8, and this is just a pictorial representation of kind of the timeline that Nuna is subject to, and so assuming we do have an ultimate favorable royalty modification determination, we will proceed full speed ahead to install gravel for a road system in a single drill site pad in this winter, so that's in February of 2015. We'll also install VSMs. These are the vertical pilings that the pipeline will sit on. We'll come back in the winter of 2016 and install all of our surface facilities. We'll install the flow lines. A little bit later in 2016, we'll move a drilling rig onto location and begin the development drilling program, and we are targeting first oil in the third quarter of 2016. Initial production rates will probably be in the 5 to 10,000 barrel a day range. We peak in the 15 to 20 plus thousand barrel a day range, and this is a project that will continue to flow through about 2045. And then that same information is just represented in the picture below. One of the questions I'm always asked is, if this royalty modification takes place, how long will it be under a 5% royalty regime, and when does it revert back to the existing base royalty terms? And the answer is, like a lot of my answers, it depends. It depends on the production rate. It depends upon the oil price. But for the purpose of this analysis, where we assume a oil price similar to today and rate profiles similar to what we believe, the project should reach that $1.25 billion net revenue target sometime around 2020, possibly as early as 2019, possibly later than 2021.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question on the last page?
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Scalia. On page 8, are you showing that production extends hopefully until 2045? Is that?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, yes, that is what it shows.
So with roughly $1.4 billion in royalties, as represented, will be paid by NUNA. That's less than $50 million a year. Is that correct?
I'll take your word for it. I can't do the math in my head that quickly. So now I'm on slide 9. And on slide 9, what I'm trying to show as simply as I can, some of the benefits that the state will enjoy in exchange for having a minor modification of royalty and ensuring that the project goes forward. You know, in the simplest form, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of jobs that will be created over the construction and development drilling phase at NUNA. We'll produce somewhere north of 50 million barrels, hopefully north of 100 million barrels of oil just from the first phase of development. We'll see capital investment in the first phase of NUNA of $1.3 billion. And when we look at our economic models of a forecast of the ultimate money that will flow to the state of Alaska in the form of royalties, production tax, ad valorem tax, and the net profit share leases, it's somewhere in the $1 billion to $1.7 billion range over the entire life of the project. One of the unique aspects of this agreement with the state of Alaska is at the end of our development, we will share publicly many of our findings about the development, specifically our costs, our development scheme, the geology, all of the techniques that we employ to maximize production, and the thought being that all of the lessons that we learn here, we will share with the state of Alaska, with the industry, and with the other North Slope developers. And that does conclude my formal comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. I just wanted to acknowledge we have staff from Senator Meyer's office in the audience. Representative Mike Chenault and Representative Mike Hawker is also following. I'm sure there's other staff that may be listening online, but those are the folks that are here with us in the room. Any additional questions? We do have the department coming up, and we certainly can ask Mr. Foley back to the microphone after we hear from the Department of Natural Resources. Is that Representative Garrett?
I can go last if you want me to. Mr. Foley, I've been public that I think this should be a decision that's withdrawn and then decided upon by the new administration, but that's neither here nor there. I look at a few things. I look that Pioneer moved forward with development wells and exploration wells in 2011, feeling that this was a producible
project under ACES. It looks that you purchased this field without any royalty relief, saying it looked very promising before any royalty modification was promised. I look at the fact that according to Dr. Scott Goldsmith, fields like Nuna that qualify for the lower GVR tax rate produce for the state somewhere between a near zero or negative net present value just for the production tax under SBA 21. And now we're seeing a royalty relief request of over 70% for at least a portion of the project. And putting all those facts together, I'm just wondering, you committed to buy it before you got royalty relief. Pioneer advertised it as a project that it felt would move forward, and it was doing development and exploration wells. You're paying very little production tax on this, something worth a near zero or a negative present value to the state. And now on top of that, after purchasing this, you want a royalty reduction of over 70%. So why is that a compelling case to me that you really need this?
So Representative Gura, through the chair, there's a lot there. Let me try and knock off a few of them. First, I think it's a little unfair to characterize this as a 70% reduction in royalty. It might be 70% for some period of time, but it's up until that $1.25 billion gross revenue target is achieved, and then it reverts back to the existing rates. Some of the other points you had made is this looked like a favorable project to Pioneer, but in reality, when we so Pioneer had a water flood project at the island to demonstrate that you can actually flow oil from the Torok and that you can inject water into the Torok reservoir. And armed with that, they made the decision to drill two exploration wells, the Nuna 1 and the Nuna 2, and that represented about $100 million in total capital for the drilling of those two wells. And at the end of that, they came to the conclusion that the development might be possible, but they also came to the conclusion that they were not going to continue their business in Alaska, and they sold all of the assets to Kalis. So now I'm going to speak to Kalis as the purchaser. When Kalis acquired this, they didn't acquire the Nuna field. They acquired all of the assets that Pioneer had in the state, one of which was Nuna. And so it's unfair to characterize it as you purchased the asset with an intention to develop it. How come you need royalty relief now? Because they purchased the entire business. And this is one piece of it and one project that, with royalty modification, will be sanctioned and will go forward on the timetable that we talked about. And I think maybe the last point that I'd like to make to address the comments that you made at the very beginning. So and I'm sorry, I've lost my train of thought.
Gera, follow up?
Sure. Just a final question. Do you know, the state obviously has a tax structure where the state pays back credits and offers deductions. Do you know what the state has given your company and your predecessor company in terms of tax credits and deductions to help move this field forward in total dollars, roughly?
Off my head, I don't know those answers. I do. I believe Governor Walker asked those same questions, and I replied to his question with an email. So I do have those numbers. I'm happy to share them with you. I just don't have them right here at my fingertips.
Thank you, Representative Gura. Thank you, Mr. Foley. I do want to set the record straight that this is a preliminary finding that is coming, some would say, from the Parnell administration, but Governor Walker is governor today, and he will make the final determination on this project, so we don't need to reset to zero. He has a team in place that can review anything that's before us, and the public comment period is open, so if people have comments that they want to make, the department stands ready to accept those comments, and again, it's a preliminary determination right now, and Mr. Barron is next at the microphone, so we can hear from Mr. Barron on a little bit more expansion on an answer to that. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Could you give me an idea or just a taste of the process that you went through with the department to evaluate as required by the royalty modification statute, the reasonable profits that comparable fields should receive, and why this field may be underneath that threshold in some way. Can you just give us a taste of how that proceeded and what documents were reviewed, and without giving anything?
So Representative Justice, and through the chair, I think it might be best if we allowed the Department of Natural Resources to make their presentation, and then we can readdress that question if you haven't had it answered. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. With that, Mr. Behrens, you can join us at the microphone if you'd like. Introduce your team so that we know who's sitting in the audience for those that might not be following on the internet streams.
Madam Chair?
Senator Dunleavy?
I'm sorry. Just a quick question for the last gentleman. Does the 30% net profits tax, does it remain in full force throughout the duration of the project? And if so, can you confirm that it's not part of this modification?
Yes, Representative, through the chair. The answer is yes, so those lease terms remain in full force and effect for so long as the lease remains in effect. And no, that net profit share interest is not impacted in any way, shape, or form by the granting of a royalty modification.
Thank you.
And for the clerk's record, that was Mr. Foley answering the question. If you could identify yourself for the record, and if you change speakers, just so that our clerks can follow appropriately, that would be helpful.
Certainly. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm Bill Barron, and I'm the Director of Oil and Gas for the State of Alaska.
Alex Novikov, Commercial Section Lead.
And I have Diane Hunt, my legislative liaison, and Denny is back with me as my lifeline for Department of Revenue. Mr. Foley took most of my slides.
Mm.
That's okay.
We love to hear it twice.
So let's do a little bit of background again so that we all get sort of grounded where we are. And Mr. Foley's given a very good description of Kalis Energy and their acquisition of Pioneer assets. That transfer actually started in October of 13, and the assets were finally transferred. The assignments were transferred in June of this year. So it's a very timely discussion in terms of process. The Nuna development is a onshore development. Their current ODS, the offshore development, is an island, which Mr. Foley has described very well. And again, the process is through the Kuparuk field. While Mr. Foley represented that there had been some ongoing dialogue with the department and the division relative to royalty modification early in the year, I can tell you that on a weekly basis, we have industry representatives coming to the division with ideas, thoughts, aspirations, and we try and work through some of their discussions. A lot of this is preliminary in terms of an application, and we don't do really any work with the company until we have a formal application on our desk. Any of the dialogues that we had with Kalis and Pioneer at the time, from basically October of last year to date, most of those discussions and economic reviews and thorough analysis of the companies was associated with the acquisition of the Pioneer assets by Kalis. And a lot of effort on the part of both the Kalis team and DNR's team relative to economic modeling and understanding of the estimated cost of abandonment and DR&R obligations, and working through a process to establish a sinking fund and bonding mechanisms relative to that function, which we have now employed at asset transfers. It's with that in mind and our history with Pioneer and ODS that we were able to move as quickly as we did on this application, because we already had a fairly good groundwork of information just off the heels of the acquisition. So again, the application came in July 1st, and it's targeting the prolonged life of the Torok. We did issue a preliminary finding on October 28th of this year. Interestingly enough, and through the chair, Representative Guerra has commented about the public notice process and procedures. Quite candidly, some of that is an error on my part. When I received the application, the approved preliminary finding, we immediately posted a public press release through the commissioner's office and posted it on my website, the division's website. It was my understanding at the time that postings of this nature on the division website are automatically triggering a notification to the public information office, which then automatically trigger the general broadcast to the citizens of Alaska. About a week later, we found that that actually did not take place. So on the 7th of November, we issued the official announcement through the PIC to trigger the 30-day public comment. Clearly nothing nefarious, nothing trying to hide anything. Ironically, and to the best interest of the state, it actually gave the citizens of Alaska about 10 extra days to look at the document because it had still been posted on my website. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody was clear that how that process took place, and we're taking actions within the division now, interactions with PIC to make sure that how do we have these things are automatically triggered through the PIC rather than doing a two-step process.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Barron, and actually I appreciate your service to the state. It's been honorable and for a long time. Just in fairness to those of us who missed the notice, the press release nowhere in the title or in the first seven or eight paragraphs ever mentioned the NUNA development. The NUNA development was way at the end and not in the title, and it just slipped by all of us, unless I'm mischaracterizing that, but I think it's accurate.
Through the chair, I believe that's correct, Representative Guerra. It was a general press release discussing the positive activities associated with several independent operators. Hillcorp was mentioned in the press release, as was Kayla. So it was a general discussion of activities, oil and gas related, at that point relative to some positive events that had taken place. So this is a little bit of a feedback loop. Some of you have, I think all of the chair and the committee have seen, I think it is also posted on LBNA's website today, the presentation that I had the pleasure to give in 2012 on royalty modification. And just so that we can get a little bit of grounding in history again, how many times royalty modifications have been applied for and what the results have been. You can see that there's a little over half a dozen of applications that have come in. Some have been withdrawn. The Pioneer Ugric in 2005 was an approved application. The Kerr-McGee was denied. Chevrons were denied. E&I's was approved in 2008. So we do get applications in. It's not a robust program that the industry takes advantage of. But they have taken advantage of it, and some are approved, and some are not. So it's never a clean slate when you, at the end of the day, it's all tallied up. So where are we today? Where are we today is that under the preliminary finding, the NUNA Turok development would be granted a 5% royalty rate reduction. Royalty down to 5% until a $1.25 billion gross revenue target has been accomplished. And this is gross production as measured from the lease, and a fixed, and the deduction, it's a wellhead deduction of 6% based on the back-out payment basically for processing of the product through Kuparuk. That's just one of the operating costs that we allowed in terms of the netback pricing. So, and we'll get into this a little bit, but I want to touch on it just briefly. What we've tried to do is structure this that this is very straight up gross revenue and almost straight value of the product. Really kind of a couple of things that the company doesn't have a lot of influence over. Right? They don't have a lot of influence over world product price. They do have some influence over rate. But that is also more of a reservoir issue than a completion issue. And I think you've already heard the activities that they're going to try and take over this very thin stratified reservoir. So it's going to be interesting completion technologies and high dollar costs to perform these functions. So the rate dependency is a function that is some within their control, but not completely. Again, the activities associated with it, we wanted to make sure that the development went forward. This was not an open-ended royalty modification. There had to be clear authorizations of expenditure with a timeline, installation facility, the installation of the facilities had to be commenced and well on its way, and production had to start in 2017. One piece that Mr. Foley, in my opinion, glossed over a little bit, these are very hard timelines, which is good. It gives the state the protection that if these benchmarks aren't made, the royalty modification is rescinded. So this puts the burden of operatorship and responsible development on a timeline to the company and removes that obligation from the state. The piece that is, I think, was a little overglossed, in my opinion, is the technology sharing. Within 24 months of initial production, 2 years, Kalis is required to issue SPE, or Society of Petroleum Engineering, standard technical documents and publications that will discuss and demonstrate what they did, their cost structure, the size and type of fracture technologies employed, their drilling techniques, full open support of technology transfer to the industry so that this type of reservoir can be targeted by other players in an accelerated manner. It takes a lot of time and energy and money to crack the nut on how to get some of these reservoirs producing. And this was a critical piece in our proposal to them in negotiations, is we want this information out to the public, out to the industry as quickly as possible. So that's a very important piece of the...
Mr. Barron.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question on that. When do you think as quickly as possibly is for the release of that information? Because Mr. Foley, I thought, referenced sometime out in the future that may not benefit Alaska as far as the timeline goes. Is it after the $1.25 billion is recovered by the state of Alaska, or, recovered by Kalis?
It is 24 months after initial production. So it's 2 years after initial production.
Thank you. Senator Giesel.
Just a couple of questions, Mr. Barron. How did you decide that the $1.25 billion was the threshold for going back to full royalty?
Through the chair, if you can hold that, okay. We'll get right to it. It's perfect tee-up for this rest of the discussion.
Okay, Senator Giesel.
Follow up. This idea of sharing technology, this is a new concept that hasn't been in other royalty relief?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. So I think it's important. That is the preliminary finding and proposed that it was agreed upon with Kalis. But I think it's also important to start with what Kalis asked for. We've given you the statute. You guys know how to read the statutes much better than I, but it's out there just so that everybody else can read it as well. But what they asked for originally was a mirror of the Ugric, Kuparik, and Nuiksik royalty modification, which is a 5% on production, but it's on a payout basis. So they wanted 5% royalty until their activities associated with the Torok at ODS and Nuna had paid out. They also wanted, after that payout, there would be a slight increase in royalties over a three-year time frame, and then on the fourth anniversary, full royalty would be back in place for all areas. That's what we started with in July. So again, this is a net payout royalty modification request for both Torok, it developed in ODS, and at Nuna, scattered over a course of years. The other thing that is part of the process is we had the opportunity to ask the companies a great deal of questions that typically companies don't like to answer when they ask for royalty modification. I know there's been some discussion about, you know, sharing a lot of information that was in the application with the general public. Unfortunately, a lot of that information is intertwined with that economic information, geologic information, and all of that is very sensitive and confidential to the company. I'm sure that Mr. Foley and others would be happy to have some of those discussions with you privately, but in terms of general public, it's very difficult for us in the state, as it's being stamped as 035 confidential. I'm obligated to keep it confidential. So with your indulgence, we'll talk in a bit of platitudes on some of these items. One of the things we asked for is we wanted to look very deeply into their reserves and how they ran their economics, because it was important for us to understand how the company could determine that this was an uneconomic project or that the project would probably not go forward without royalty modification. I think it's a real fundamental question that we had to be able to answer to our satisfaction. One of the things we found out that they were looking at only proven reserves, better known in the industry as 1P, which basically says that there's a 90% chance that there's actually going to be more reserves recovered. So they're looking at a very thin slice of recovery, 10% of what they were saying is recoverable reserves, 10% were used in their economics. The price, so that's a very conservative perspective. But it's also maybe a very fair one. I'm trying to strike a balance between analysis and critique. The reason why that is possibly very fair is because of the structure of the Torok Reservoir. It's very difficult to produce. The ability to drill horizontally and fracture a producer is one thing. Having to do that with your injectors, as Mr. Foley indicated, is unique. It's more costly. And you just don't know if you're going to get pressure maintenance and sweep from a water flood in this kind of formation. It's still an unknown. They've been able to put some water away at ODS. The efficiency of that sweep and the pressure support resulting from the water is yet to be determined. So that clouds a bit of your 2P and your 3P reserves. So in their model, they used 1P. So we considered that to be interesting but conservative. The price that they used, they had a price structure that floated for the first couple of years and then was fixed for all years out at the same price. I really can't tell you what that price was, but at the time we thought it was conservative. Today we think it's radically high. It's amazing what a few months will do. I'm trying to give you some boundaries there. They also capped, they had a fixed OPEX and fixed CAPEX. So basically what I'm trying to get to here is we believed at the time that it was a conservative deterministic model. And I think it's important for everybody to grasp the idea of a deterministic model because we don't do deterministic models. The result of their economics was that there was a very low rate of return before federal income tax. We also took note that it was before federal income tax. Just a kind of one of those, it's interesting observation. But again, a very low rate of return. So state modeling. We don't use deterministic values. We then leaned into Kalis and said, okay, we understand what your 1P reserves are. We'd like to know what your 2Ps and 3Ps are. And if anybody had the opportunity to go back to the 2012 testimony, there was a series of graphs that showed some statistical distributions. In the engineering world for reservoir management, reservoir reserves are usually described in log normal distributions, which means it's not a normal curve, it's a log normal. And what we did is we asked Kalis, let's look at your internal documents, your third-party consultant. We looked at those documents and established a log normal distribution for reserves. We also added a little bit of risk associated with that, given what kind of reservoir it was and the unknown characteristics that they might encounter. We did the same thing with oil price, and I think I've got a slide for that in a moment. And we did the same thing with cost. We said, okay, you've given us a fixed cost for capital and a fixed cost for operating expenses. Give us a range. Let's work with it. And we backtracked and validated some of those numbers in terms of highs and lows. And we built distributions around those figures as well. We also did the difference, another difference between our models and the Kalis model, we looked at incrementals because the statute was for the prolonged life of the Torok. So what we looked at was the NUNA plus the ODS and the ODS only, and then did a subtraction of those two to find the value of the NUNA portion of the TOROC. We do our economics AFIT, and we ran this model numerous times.
Mr. Burns, that would be after federal income tax?
Yes, ma'am.
AFIT?
Yes, ma'am. That is after federal income tax.
Madam Chair?
Senator Dunleavy.
Can you just clarify what the P's are, the 1P, the 2P, the 3Ps? I may have missed that. What are the P's?
In the engineering world, SPE standard is 1P is proven reserves, 2P is probable reserves, and the 3P is possible reserves. So as the number of P gets bigger, the confidence that you're going to recover those reserves is diminished.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Thank you, Mr. Folk. I'm sorry, Mr. Barnes. There. Please identify yourself when you move back and forth for the clerk.
Okay. So the slide 8 is a price forecast, just as an example of our distribution. And when we were running the models at the time of the analysis, we ranged it from everything from $50 a barrel to $130 and built a normal distribution around those figures, with a mean at that time being 90. So again, I'm just using that as a reference of how these statistical distributions are built. So when we ran our model, the next slide, slide 9.
Can I ask a question on the last slide?
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Just on the last slide, what is that red area? Is that gross revenue? Is that profits? What is that red area that you
have? That is the dollar per barrel. This is a distribution curve to recognize the frequency of events at a certain product price. So in this case, the highest point is like at $90. That's $90 a barrel, and that's where most of the distribution landed. So it's a frequency distribution curve.
Oh, okay, thanks.
So as we run this stochastic model, Monte Carlo technique, tens of thousands of times, and let the computer generate possible results, which is, I think, is a very important aspect to understand, that we don't know what product price is going to be at any given point in time. We don't know what production rate is going to be at any given point in time. We don't know what capital costs are going to be or their OPEX. It could range, and that's why we build these distribution models. And any of these events can take place against each other at any point in time. And that's why you do a Monte Carlo analysis, to get a range of results. And what we found was, when we did this, historically we have used what has been best described, and I think I gave testimony in this in 2012, as the prudent investor model. And we were looking at a 15% rate of return prudent investor model, which means a prudent investor would invest in a project if it was reasonably expected to be positive at 15% rate of return. So what you have now on your exhibits is, again, a probability distribution of results. And a couple of interesting things came to mind. This is roughly a tipping point project. 50% of the cases came out to be positive at 15% rate of return, and 50% of the cases were negative or were not profitable at 15% rate of return. So we started looking at that, going, that's an interesting dilemma for us now to work through, in terms of, is this really the right model to be using? Not model in terms of the economic model, but let's look at the kind of company that we're dealing with. And I'm in no way trying to diminish the value of Kalis to the state or their company and their reputation. When we were looking at Kalis, we recognized a couple of important things. Again, the project is at the tipping point. The median case is negative. Kalis has a higher cost of capital. I think Mr. Foley acknowledged in his testimony today that they are getting private equity funding for this. $1 billion, I think, was the number that Pat said. The companies that, and again, if you go back to one of the original slides, the companies that we have been looking at historically have been the Conocos, the BPs, the Kerr McGees, Chevrons, those kind of companies that are internationally diversified portfolio project companies, worldwide standards. Kalis is basically a single asset startup company who is having to go to the private equity market to receive funding for these projects. That's a limited pool that can pony up $1 billion for activities in Alaska. That's a fairly sizable company to be able to get equity from, the Apollo Group that they've mentioned. Again, previously the companies we're dealing with were more diversified. So we started asking ourselves, are we looking at this at the right way? Is the 15% really the right answer? And again, in trying to be fair and equitable in evaluating the company's application. So we thought, you know, we've got a company internal to Alaska that does this kind of stuff. So we reached out to the Permanent Fund and asked them, if you were going to be investing in this kind of project, what kind of rate of return would you be looking at? And the answer we got from the Permanent Fund Investing Group was somewhere between 20, 25, 17, much higher than 15. So 25% rate of return for an upstream oil and gas from the Permanent Fund. That's interesting. So what we did is we reran the economics targeting 17.5% rate of return. Again, just to try and get a sense of how sensitive the project is to rate of return. And again, recognizing this is a private equity funded project. The next slide is the resultant of that effort. Now we've got 65% of the cases are not positive at 17.5%. So by elevating the requirement for rate of return, the failure rate has increased. We would all expect that. But we didn't expect it to go as far as it did. The mean case now is a negative expected monetary value. Only a very few cases became positive. So when we looked at that, we said, private equity company, project at the tipping point, 17.5% is clearly, I mean, if we went to 25, this would even be worse. And I can tell you that we did run this. We ran this at 17.5 target. We ran it at 20. We ran it at 25. A series of these to try and, but for illustrative purposes, this is at 17.5. So as we worked our way through that, we started asking ourselves the question, best interest to the state. We recognized that this is a reservoir that is risky, more so than the conventional plays of Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk. We wanted an opportunity to try and promote new drilling techniques to the state to see if they could work, and if they could work, how well, and how could we transfer that technology. We wanted to encourage the development of this kind of resource, this kind of play. This is also the sort of a play that Badami is. Meltwater, tarn. There are several plays like this that have not been robustly positive. The companies have struggled with them. We wanted to focus this on the single formation from the new development site. And I raised that point very cleanly and clearly because the Kalis application wanted the Torok from ODS and Nuna. And we were concentrating on this needed to be limited to the new development area. We wanted to establish clear milestones that the company would be held to. We did not want to put in something that would adversely affect the MPSL benefits. We wanted to recognize that production and recovery and product price were critical factors. It's also interesting to note that essentially, except for production, recovery and product price are completely out of the control of the operator. So we had some lengthy discussions internally and lengthy discussions with Kalis in terms of options, alternatives. We talked about ratcheting down and up on product price. We talked about sliding scales, just clean curves on product price. Again, trying to take things that, that the operator didn't have a lot of control of, but which were drivers of the economics. We did several other variants of those aspects. And we also talked about a gross revenue target. And the reason why we landed on a gross revenue is we also recognized that if they were successful, technically, what we didn't want to do is diminish the state's ability to recover product if they had high rates at low price. So if we only gave them a product price royalty modification, they could enjoy robust production, low price, and gain the royalty modification. We wanted to structure something that if the technology worked and their production was high, we would also benefit from that because it would truncate the time of which they were under royalty modification. So we were trying to blend the balance of how do we benefit the state with elevated production and risked product price. So that's how we kind of landed with the proposal of the gross revenue target. Now, through the chair, to Senator Giesel's question. See, I did remember you had a question. Concerning how did we land on the 1.25? If the next exhibit in front of you is the expected monetary value at 17.5 and a 1.25 billion gross revenue target. What I'd like to point to your attention to is the number off to the right-hand side where it says mean in the table. The mean in this exhibit of all the runs in this case, the mean is -7. That still says the project on a mean basis is negative. However, that is statistically might as well be zero. What we did is we worked our way back from 2.5, 3.5, and worked our way backwards down the scale to a gross revenue target at 17.5% that was, again, at a tipping point of value to the company. So the project is at a mean of -7, essentially zero. That's where the project, any less than that, and the project would be more negative. Any higher than that, the state would have been leaving too much on the table, in our opinion. So the cost of this is essentially that we forego $44 million in royalty to get the project moving forward. So it's got a couple of slides left, but again, it's the $44 million, and I'm going to get to that and just back into that because it's also got some important aspects. We expect to receive, and Mr. Coley recognized that, again, variance in product price, et cetera, could be anywhere from $1 to $1.7 billion value to the state in revenue, taxes, et cetera. When we did it, it was 1.3, 1.4. Again, the spattering of many variables have an impact there. We actually believe that the project would either not go forward or would be significantly delayed without royalty modification as a private equity funded company. And that gave us great pause and concern because we want this kind of project to move forward. We also want to make sure that we are doing it in a way that protects the state as robustly as possible. But again, it was that, and we did, everything was on an economic-driven basis, so we tried to find the tipping point of the project in terms of the gross revenue target. And then we asked ourselves a question. It's a very simple question. Is, let's assume that we're right, and the project does not go forward without royalty modification. Okay, so that's the bad side. But if it were delayed, what would the value of the state be? The last slide, essentially the last slide, slide 16, is a very simple curve, but it's a very important curve to look at. The horizontal line, what I'm trying to represent is the net present value to the state in its decision-making abilities. The red bar on the long the axis is the $44 million. That's what we would forego under the current proposal. The blue curve is no royalty modification with a year delay, 2-year delay, 3-year delay, et cetera. What we found was very interesting, that by not taking action today, actually was going to cost the state more money in net present value than if we delayed at all. If we delayed even a year, we would lose roughly $79 million in value to the state. So on one hand, we're risking the 44, but accelerating the development of the asset, gaining and having hard lines, hard milestones for the company, and information transfer. If we didn't do it and the project was delayed a year and there was no royalty modification, we would be out more than we would be out by granting the royalty modification.
Representative Josephson.
Mr. Barron, the figure of lost royalty of $75 million, where did that come from? It was a previous figure that I read. I'm confident I read that.
I believe in the preliminary finding, there was a reduction of $75 million in royalty, but with the additional taxes rolled onto that, the state's total revenue loss was $44
million. I see.
Just for clarity, Mr. Barron, is the $44 million a total loss or a loss per year?
That's a total loss.
Thank you. Representative Garrett.
Can you go back to the last page, the prior page? Up there it says the company expects this to be a roughly 30-year producing project. So $1.3 billion in state revenue, just by a rough calculation, seems to be about $35 million a year. Is that $1.3 billion in state revenue that you anticipate from the project minus the funds the state rebates back to the company in tax credits and tax deductions, or is that $1.3 billion that we get clear? Do we get $1.3 billion, or is that reduced by the amount of tax credits and tax deductions for development and operation?
Chair, Representative, this is what the state expects to get at the end of the day. Net to the state.
Net.
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good question. Is it possible to recover the forgiven 7.5% to the back end after the $1.25 billion gross revenue is met? If not, why?
Through the chair, Senator, let me see if I can capture the question. What you're asking is there a way for Talus to repay the loss through the royalty modification? Is that the point?
Yes. Give them a break on the front end, expecting it to be taxed on the back end. Yes.
Through the chair, as we work through the discussions with Talus, some of these comments and options were discussed, and as part of the robust negotiations that took place is how we ended up not requiring that, but we reduced the gross revenue target. It was originally higher, and we pushed it back to the 1.2. So we compensated as best we could for that loss of not the repayment, but by pushing the gross revenue target down to give us compensation and accelerate the time in which we would regain our full royalty.
Senator Dunleavy, any follow-up?
So it never was recouped then?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
For the presentation, Minister?
For where we're at right now.
Last slide, Madam Chair. The members of the division still maintain that this is in the best interest of the state. This is a well-crafted, very thoughtful royalty modification to jumpstart a project. It gives us immediate development into new reserves. Like I said, delays actually cost us more. It's focused on the scope of a single formation from the new development. Again, we peeled off already some of the developed areas and said, nope, not so much. It has very clear milestones, which has always been a bit of a contentious issue with your body in terms of how do we make sure companies are doing what we ask them to do and hold them to a fine line. we acknowledge that concern by your body, and we've rolled that into this proposal. It does not adversely affect the MPSLs. So the benefit of net profit leases do trigger in when they do reach payout. The state does gain the 1.3 net present value 3% discount. And this targets a pretty elusive reservoir on the North Slope, which then is automatically triggering 24 months after first production the technology transfer to the rest of the industry. That's our formal presentation. We're available for any questions.
Are there questions from committee members?
Yeah,
Senator Dunleavy?
He had to leave the room momentarily, Senator.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Mr. Barron, the net profit share leases, I sort of got schooled a little bit on this yesterday, as it were. But this is unique to this unit. Is it? That's one question. And how, even though it was sort of explained to me, can you give me an explanation of how this came to be? Because it seems to suggest that the unit should have been a more profitable place to do business.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, net profit leases are not unique to this unit. We have several of them throughout the state, mostly in the North Slope. The idea, I believe, was first hatched in some federal leases with the idea, and the whole idea is you have your base royalty, but once you reach a payout on that lease, so all your expenses, all your capital, everything associated with the development of that property, when the company reaches payout, they then actually pay more back to the state. So the idea was to try and encourage companies to come in and at least let them make a get to a payout position and then pay the state more. So there was the balancing act between the state or the royalty owner and the company in terms of that's just one of the uniquenesses of MPSL leases. They are used federally. There are several other states that have them. We've got a few of them. We did a couple of lease sales that had those terms in them. They're out there, but they're not really robust. They're not used a lot. This just happens to have some of the MPSLs.
Well, I guess, so your job now, Mr. Barron, is to Ms. Rutherford and recommend this? Is that how this will work? Or procedurally, if you could explain.
Sure.
Where we go from here.
Through the chair, as best of my knowledge, we are clearly still in the public review period of the preliminary finding. Once we gather the comments from those that choose to comment, and we've had very few comments to date, but a few, we will gather those up and prepare unless there's something in a way that is major that we have missed or a comment that needs to be fully addressed in a modification of the proposed language of the agreement, we would write a final finding for the commissioner's signature. And upon signature, that deal is done. Clearly, with the new commissioner and the new administration, we've got some background work to do in terms of just educating and walking the new administration through all of the hard work that Alex and his team have done. We have spent countless hours running hundreds of thousands of economic runs to get to where we are today. And we're happy to share that with the administration as they go through a transition process. But that's the process as I understand it.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Most leases are bid by the state at a 12.5% royalty. There have been some like this one, some at 16%, this one at 12.5% plus a 30% profit share. The state, when they put leases out to bid, they use the higher rate when a field is more promising, right? More potentially productive. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, wish I had an exhibit to show you, but historically in the industry, 12.5% royalty is very, very common. that is pretty much common throughout all domestic regimes. Many years ago, the state of Alaska recognized that there was some prolific areas, some higher potential areas on the North Slope, and there was a designated line that above which the royalties were 16 2/3. That's pretty common now, that those areas are still 16 2/3, everything else is 12 1/2. In a couple of the lease sales, the idea was propagated and the lease terms included the net profit sharing component. In the last, at least the last four lease sales and probably 3 or 4 years before that, we have gone away from that. These are the leases now very commonly do not include a net profit share because they're very complicated to administer, very complicated. And when a company comes in to purchase a lease, and this is to some degree Senator Dunleavy's question, the company comes in to lease a property. In this manner, Kalis has just picked up roughly 300,000 acres in the most recent lease sale, which was the third largest lease sale in terms of value in the state's history for the North Slope. They bought 300,000 acres and have maybe just a smidgen of an idea of what they've got their hands on. They now have to go through a tremendous piece of work of shooting seismic, gathering the data, making the analysis, before they even decide where they're going to put in their first exploration well. And then even then, that may not be beneficial to them. They'll get information, but it may be a dry hole. And when you have wells that are exploration wells of now over $80 million to drill and they're dry, that's a huge investment on a company for nothing. They get data, but they've got just a hole in the ground. So the companies come in without a great deal, necessarily a lot of information when they buy the lease. So we try and make the lease sales competitive, but we don't try and make them with an understanding that we're trying to impose where we think it's more likely to have greater production. I mean, the Badami area, for example, would be in that 16 2/3 royalty demarcation area. Hasn't been a robust field. I mean, that's the risk that they take. And they go in with their eyes open that this is the terms of the royalty. When they get more information, this is the terms of the lease. But with that new information, your body, I think very wisely, decided that there would be another opportunity for them to come in and ask for assistance by the state, any company, to come in and say, we need a little help here to get going. And that's where the royalty modification statutes were created. It's a tool in our toolbox. It's a tool in the industry's toolbox. What we have to be careful of is when we exercise that tool to make sure that we just don't use it unwieldily, that we use it wisely. And I think the way we've structured this agreement is very sound in its approach to address many issues that really do bring benefit to the state.
Representative Garrett, follow up.
Through the chair, thank you. Just going back to the basic question, when it's more than a 12.5% royalty, is that reflective of the state's view that it's a more promising field?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, we are issuing leases. We don't know if there's even a field there. When we sell the lease, we don't know if there's anything there or not. We drew a demarcation line on the North Slope map and said north of that is 16 2/3, south of that is 12 1/2. We have no idea whether there will be anything discovered or not at the time of the lease sale.
Senator Bishop.
So, thank you, Madam Chairman. So the 322,000 acres, is that 12.5% or 16%?
I believe it's a mix of both.
Okay.
I can follow up, Senator, if you care to.
Mr. Foley, do you have that answer?
For the record, this is Pat Foley with Kalis. And all of the leases that Kalis purchased at the last lease sale are all 16 2/3. There is an area in the other southern portion of the offered land that had a 1/8, but those were not the leases. There were also leases that were adjacent to some of the federal tracts that had a 1/8 royalty. And I might have misspoke. There might have been a handful, like single-digit leases that actually have the 1/8 royalty. Of the 126 tracks, well over 100 of them are 1/6 royalty.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. Senator Bishop, any follow-up?
Like I said, through the chair, Senator, this is Bill Barron. I think Mr. Foley is correct. The lion's share was, but I think it was a mix. After going through 260-some-odd leases at that lease sale, it's kind of mind-numbing to try and remember which one went to who and where it was on the map.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Can you, for those reporters in the audience or individuals listening at home, when is the cutoff date for the comment period?
Cutoff is the 12th of this month.
December 12th, 2014.
That's correct.
And because the general public doesn't have the statute that you provided us, AS 3805.180J1B states that modification is necessary to prolong economic life of an oil or gas field or pool because without modification, future production is not economically feasible, and royalty modification must be in the best interest of the state. Is that a fairly accurate overview of what that statute
Yes, ma'am, it is.
And so the testimony that you've provided us today is the state's effort, specifically the Department of Natural Resources' effort, into explaining to the general public as well as to the legislature the steps that you took to protect the state's interests. Is that fair?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Barron, your commissioner on November 27th, he was quoted in the Alaska Dispatch as saying, what I found, they are expecting some pretty significant returns on the investments they make, and so ultimately, that was one of the things I took into account. I'm not in the business as a legislator. I'm in the business as a legislator of making sure that we get a fair return for the state and also for industry, but why should I be comforted that he was looking at something that would produce pretty significant returns for this company?
Mr. Barron, before you answer that, Representative Guerra, could you tell us the date of the article that you're quoting from, the source of the article, and then I am assuming, which is not very good to do, that you're quoting Commissioner Balash, former Commissioner Balash. So if you could just give us so that people can reference what you're speaking to.
Yeah, sorry, Madam Chair. That was the Alaska Dispatch on November 27th, and that was a word-for-word quote on the second page of the article from Mr. Balash.
Thank you.
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, I don't know that I can adequately respond to the question. It was not my quote. It was the former commissioner's. I can, though, I believe, articulate a little bit that this is going to be one of the very first, if not the first, private equity-funded projects on the North Slope, possibly in Alaska, for oil and gas. And if we can structure an arrangement, as I think we have in this royalty modification, that will make these kind of projects economically viable for private equity to come into the state, I think that will be a positive step forward for the state. I think it's important for people to grasp the nature of the companies that are now coming into the state. The Kalises, the Hillcorps, the Brooks Range, 70 and 148 LLC, Armstrong, any Repsol to a little different degree, those two. These are companies, that the Royals, the Blue Crests, the Furies, the list just keeps going. These are companies that are going to need private equity funding. They are not wildly diversified corporations. So if by structuring something that is not onerously diminishing the value to the state on this project, but recognizes that to the industry and to the private equity sector, that the state is willing to look at these kind of projects positively, and the company does make a positive rate of return, that actually could play into large dividends for the state for future investments and future players to be able to develop their projects through private equity. That's who the players are that we're getting. I mean, this is a reality that we have to get our arms around. These are the players that are coming in that hold a great deal of acreage in the state right now for exploration activities. And it's important for us to try and figure out how to make these kind of companies be successful so that we can continue the development of our natural resources.
Is there a follow-up?
Yeah, just the last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. Do you disagree with the Scott Goldsmith analysis or have any opinion on it? And in his analysis this summer, he said fields like Nuna, the post-2002 production units, will generate in production taxes somewhere either from a negative net present value to the state or a near zero net present value to the state, just the production tax part. Do you have any opinion on that?
Through the chair, no, sir. I have no opinion on it.
Representative Barron, follow up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. I'd like to go back to two other points just to call them out for those that are listening. From your presentation, not an opinion, but I see in your presentation on slide 15 that the economics that your department has run assert that a delay would be longer and more costly to the state of Alaska as compared to the impact of the royalty modification. Is that fair?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
And it would shorten the overall economic life of the project.
Yes, ma'am.
And then to try to protect the state's interest, again, your slides reflect to this committee and those listening that we have tried, or you have tried, through negotiations on this particular royalty release to make sure that Alaska receives production timely by saying, one, that the facilities have to be started to be installed by December 31st of next year, 2015. Is that accurate?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
And then the production must start by no later than March 31st, 2017.
That's correct.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Director Barron, I just want to kind of go back and just kind of give a thumbnail sketch, close the loop on this. Okay, so $1.3 billion, give or take a little bit, net in profit back to the state.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
With a $44 million, give or take a few dollars, investment from our standpoint.
That's a fair characterization.
Okay, so not to be flippant, but that's almost a rounding error to get $1.3 billion bucks.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Any other questions from those online? Senator Dunleavy.
No questions, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I'll take a brief at ease. Just wanted to make sure that we were, if we wanted to have anyone else back before the body to testify. There are no other questions at this time. Let me go to my trusty meeting minute notes. Are there any comments from members before we adjourn? Seeing and hearing none, this committee meeting is adjourned at 2:42. Thank you for attending.